This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Coming of Mr. Quinn, a Harley Quinn short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser.
The Coming of Mr. Quinn. It was New Year's Eve. The elder members of the house party at Royston were assembled in the big hall. Mr. Satterthwaite was glad that the young people had gone to bed. He was not fond of young people in herds. He thought them uninteresting and crude. They lacked subtlety, and as life went on, he had become increasingly fond of subtleties. Mr. Satterthwaite was 62, a little, bent, dried-up man with a peering face, oddly elf-like, and an intense and inordinate interest in other people's lives. All his life, so to speak, he had sat in the front row of the stalls, watching various dramas of human nature unfold before him. His role had always been that of the onlooker. Only now, with old age holding him in its clutch, he found himself increasingly critical of the drama submitted to him. He demanded now something a little out of the common. There was no doubt that he had a flair for these things. He knew instinctively when the elements of drama were at hand. Like a warhorse, he sniffed the scent. Since his arrival at Royston this afternoon, that strange inner sense of his had stirred and bid him be ready. Something interesting was happening, or going to happen. The house party was not a large one. There was Tom Evesham, their genial, good-humoured host, and his serious political wife, who had been before her marriage Lady Laura Keane. There was Sir Richard Conway, soldier, traveller, and sportsman. There were six or seven young people whose names Mr. Satterthwaite had not grasped, and there were the Portals. It was the Portals who interested Mr. Satterthwaite. He had never met Alex Portal before, but he knew all about him. He had known his father and his grandfather. Alex Portal ran pretty true to type. He was a man of close on 40, fair-haired and blue-eyed like all the Portals, fond of sport, good at games, devoid of imagination. Nothing unusual about Alex Portal, the usual good, sound English stock. But his wife was different. She was, Mr. Satterthwaite knew, an Australian. Portal had been out in Australia 2 years ago, had met her out there and had married her and brought her home. She had never been to England previous to her marriage. All the same, she wasn't at all like any other Australian woman Mr. Satterthwaite had met. He observed her now, covertly. Interesting woman. Very. So still, and yet so alive. Alive, that was just it. Not exactly beautiful. No, you wouldn't call her beautiful. But there was a kind of calamitous magic about her that you couldn't miss, that no man could miss. The masculine side of Mr. Satterthwaite spoke there, but the feminine side, for Mr. Satterthwaite had a large share of femininity, was equally interested in another question. Why did Mrs. Portal dye her hair? No other man would probably have known that she dyed her hair, but Mr. Satterthwaite knew. He knew all those things, and it puzzled him. Many dark women dyed their hair blonde. He had never before come across a fair woman who dyed her hair black. Everything about her intrigued him. In a queer, intuitive way, he felt certain that she was either very happy or very unhappy, but he didn't know which. And it annoyed him not to know. Furthermore, there was the curious effect she had upon her husband. "He adores her," said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself, "but sometimes he's, yes, afraid of her. It's very interesting. That's uncommonly interesting." Portal drank too much, that was certain, and he had a curious way of watching his wife when she wasn't looking. "Nerves," said Mr. Satterthwaite. "The fellow's all nerves. She knows it too, but she won't do anything about it." He felt very curious about the pair of them. Something was going on that he couldn't fathom. He was roused from his meditations on the subject by the solemn chiming of the big clock in the corner. 12 o'clock, said Evesham. New Year's Day. Happy New Year, everybody. As a matter of fact, that clock's 5 minutes fast. I don't know why the children wouldn't wait up and see the New Year in. I don't suppose for a minute they've really gone to bed, said his wife placidly. They're probably putting hairbrushes or something in our beds. That sort of thing does so amuse them, I can't think why. We should never have been allowed to do such a thing in my young days.
Autre temps, autre moeur, said Conway, smiling.
He was a tall, soldierly-looking man. Both he and Evesham were much of the same type. Honest, upright, kindly men with no great pretensions to brains. In my young days we all joined hands in a circle and sang Auld Lang Syne, continued Lady Laura. Should old acquaintance be forgot? So touching, I always think the words are.
Evesham moved uneasily.
Oh, drop it, Laura, he muttered. Not here.
He strode across the wide hall where they were sitting and switched on an extra light.
Very stupid of me, said Lady Laura, sotto voce. Reminds him of poor Mr. Capel, of course.
My dear, is the fire too hot for you?
Eleanor Portal made a brusque movement.
Thank you. I'll move my chair back a little.
What a lovely voice she had. One of those low, murmuring, echoing voices that stay in your memory, thought Mr. Satterthwaite. Her face was in shadow now. What a pity. From her place in the shadow she spoke again.
Mr. Capel?
Yes, the man who originally owned this house. He shot himself, you know.
Oh, very well, Tom, dear. I won't speak of it unless you like. It was a great shock for Tom, of course, because he was here when it happened.
So were you, weren't you, Sir Richard?
Yes, Lady Laura.
An old grandfather clock in the corner groaned, wheezed, snorted asthmatically, and then struck 12.
Happy New Year, Tom, grunted Evesham perfunctorily.
Lady Laura wound up her knitting with some deliberation.
Well, we've seen the New Year in, she observed,
and added, looking towards Mrs. Portal,
what do you think, my dear?
Eleanor Portal rose quickly to her feet.
Bed, by all means, she said lightly.
She's very pale, thought Mr. Satterthwaite, as he too rose and began busying himself with candlesticks.
She's not usually as pale as that.
He lighted her candle and handed it to her with a funny little old-fashioned bow. She took it from him with a word of acknowledgement and went slowly up the stairs. Suddenly, a very odd impulse swept over Mr. Satterthwaite. He wanted to go after her, to reassure her. He had the strangest feeling that she was in danger of some kind. The impulse died down, and he felt ashamed. He was getting nervy too. She hadn't looked at her husband as she went up the stairs, but now she turned her head over her shoulder and gave him a long, searching glance, which had a queer intensity in it. It affected Mr. Satterthwaite very oddly. He found himself saying good night to his hostess in quite a flustered manner.
I'm sure I hope it will be a happy New Year, Lady Laura was saying, but the political situation seems to me to be fraught with grave uncertainty.
I'm sure it is, said Mr. Satterthwaite earnestly. I'm sure it is.
I only hope, continued Lady Laura, without the least change of manner, that it will be a dark man who first crosses the threshold. You know that superstition, I suppose, Mr. Satterthwaite?
No?
You surprise me. To bring luck to the house, it must be a dark man who first steps over the doorstep on New Year's Day.
Dear me, I hope I shan't find anything very unpleasant in my bed. I never trust the children. They have such very high spirits.
Shaking her head in sad foreboding, Lady Laura moved majestically up the staircase. With the departure of the women, chairs were pulled in closer round the blazing logs on the big open hearth.
Say when,
said Evesham hospitably, as he held up the whisky decanter. When everybody had said when, the talk reverted to the subject which had been tabooed before.
Are you new, Derek Capel, didn't you, Satterthwaite?
Asked Conway.
Slightly, yes.
And you, Portal?
No, I never met him.
So fiercely and defensively did he say it that Mr. Satterthwaite looked up in surprise.
I always hate it when Laura brings up the subject, said Evesham slowly. After the tragedy, you know, this place was sold to a big manufacturer fellow. He cleared out after a year. Didn't suit him or something. A lot of tommyrot was talked about the place being haunted, of course. And it gave the house a bad name. Then when Laura got me to stand for West Kittleby, of course it meant living up in these parts, and it wasn't so easy to find a suitable house. Royston was going cheap, and, well, in the end I bought it. Ghosts are all tommyrot, but all the same, one doesn't exactly care to be reminded that you're living in a house where one of your friends shot himself. Poor old Derek. We shall never know why he did it.
He won't be the first or the last fellow who's shot himself without being able to give a reason, said Alex Portal heavily. He rose and poured himself out another drink, splashing the whiskey in with a liberal hand.
There's something very wrong with him, said Mr. Satterthwaite to himself. Very wrong indeed. I wish I knew what it was all about.
Gad, said Conway. Listen to the wind. It's a wild night.
A good night for ghosts to walk, said Portal with a reckless laugh.
All the devils in hell are abroad tonight.
According to Lady Laura, even the blackest of them would bring us luck, observed Conway with a laugh.
Hark to that.
The wind rose in another terrific wail,
and as it died away there came three loud knocks on the big nailed door.
Everyone started.
Who on earth can that be at this time of night? Cried Evesham.
They stared at each other.
I will open it, said Evesham. The servants have gone to bed.
He strode across to the door, fumbled a little over the heavy bars, and finally flung it open. An icy blast of wind came sweeping into the hall. Framed in the doorway stood a man's figure, tall and slender. To Mr. Satterthwaite, watching, he appeared, by some curious effect of the stained glass above the door, to be dressed in every colour of the rainbow. Then, as he stepped forward, he showed himself to be a thin, dark man, dressed in motoring clothes. I must really apologise for this intrusion, said the stranger, in a pleasant, level voice, but my car broke down. Nothing much. My chauffeur is putting it to rights, but it will take half an hour or so, and it is so confoundedly cold outside. He broke off, and Evesham took up the thread quickly.
I should think it was. Come in and have a drink. We can't give you any assistance about the car, can we?
No, thanks. My man knows what to do. By the way, my name is Quinn. Harley Quinn.
Oh, sit down, Mr. Quinn, said Evesham. Sir Richard Conway, Mr. Satterthwaite, my name is Evesham.
Mr. Quinn acknowledged the introductions and dropped into the chair that Evesham had hospitably pulled forward. As he sat, some effect of the firelight threw a bar of shadow across his face, which gave almost the impression of a mask. Evesham threw a couple more logs onto the fire.
A drink?
Thanks.
Evesham brought it to him and asked as he did so, So you know this part of the world well, Mr. Quinn?
I passed through it some years ago.
Really?
Yes, this house belonged then to a man called Capel.
Ah, yes, said Evesham. Poor Derek Capel. You knew him?
Yes, I knew him. Evesham's manner underwent a faint change, almost imperceptible to one who had not studied the English character. Before, it had contained a subtle reserve. Now this was laid aside. Mr. Quinn had known Derek Capel. He was the friend of a friend, and as such was vouched for and fully accredited.
Astounding affair, that, he said confidentially. We were just talking about it. I can tell you, it went against the grain buying this place. If there had been anything else suitable, but there wasn't, you see. I was in the house the night he shot himself. So was Conway. And upon my word, I've always expected his ghost to walk.
A very inexplicable business, said Mr. Quinn slowly and deliberately. And he paused with the air of an actor who has just spoken an important cue.
Oh, you may well say inexplicable,
burst in Conway. "The thing's a black mystery. Always will be."
"I wonder," said Mr. Quinn noncommittally.
"Yes, Sir Richard?
You were saying?"
"Astounding. That's what it was. Here's a man in the prime of life, gay, light-hearted, without a care in the world, 5 or 6 old pals staying with him, top of his spirits at dinner, full of plans for the future. And from the dinner table, he goes straight upstairs to his room, takes a revolver from a drawer and shoots himself. Why? Nobody ever knew. Nobody ever will know."
"Isn't that rather a sweeping statement, Sir Richard?" asked Mr. Quinn, smiling. Conway stared at him.
"What do you mean? I don't understand."
"A problem is not necessarily unsolvable, because it has remained unsolved."
"Oh, come, man. If nothing came out at the time, it's not likely to come out now, 10 years afterwards."
Mr. Quinn shook his head gently. "I disagree with you. The evidence of history is against you. The contemporary historian never writes such a true history as the historian of a later generation. It is a question of getting the true perspective, of seeing things in proportion. If you like to call it so, it is like everything else, a question of relativity." Alex Portal leant forward, his face twitching painfully.
"You're right, Mr. Quinn," he cried. "You are right. Time does not dispose of a question. It only presents it anew in different guise."
Evesham was smiling tolerantly.
"Then you mean to say, Mr. Quinn, that if we were to hold, let's say, a court of inquiry tonight into the circumstances of Derek Capel's death, we are as likely to arrive at the truth as we should have been at the time?"
"More likely, Mr. Evesham. The personal equation has largely dropped out, and you will remember facts as facts without seeking to put your own interpretation upon them." Evesham frowned doubtfully. "One must have a starting point, of course," said Mr. Quinn in his quiet, level voice. "A starting point is usually a theory. One of you must have a theory, I am sure. How about you, Sir Richard?"
Conway frowned thoughtfully. "Well, of course," he said apologetically. "We thought, naturally we all thought, there must be a woman in it somewhere. It's usually either that or money, isn't it? And it certainly wasn't money. No trouble of that description. So, what else could it have been?"
Mr. Satterthwaite started. He had leant forward to contribute a small remark of his own, and in the act of doing so, he had caught sight of a woman's figure crouched against the balustrade of the gallery above. She was huddled down against it, invisible from everywhere but where he himself sat, and she was evidently listening with strained attention to what was going on below. So immovable was she that he hardly believed the evidence of his own eyes. But he recognized the pattern of the dress easily enough. An old-world brocade. It was Eleanor Portal. And suddenly, all the events of the night seemed to fall into pattern. Mr. Quinn's arrival. No fortuitous chance, but the appearance of an actor when his cue was given. There was a drama being played in the big hall at Royston tonight. A drama nonetheless real, in that one of the actors was dead. Oh yes, Derek Capel had a part in the play. Mr. Satterthwaite was sure of that. And again, suddenly, a new illumination came to him. This was Mr. Quinn's doing. It was he who was staging the play, was giving the actors their cues. He was at the heart of the mystery, pulling the strings, making the puppets work. He knew everything, even to the presence of the woman crouched against the woodwork upstairs. Yes, he knew. Sitting well back in his chair, secure in his role of audience, Mr. Satterthwaite watched the drama unfold before his eyes. Quietly and naturally, Mr. Quinn was pulling the strings, setting his puppets in motion. "A woman, yes," he murmured thoughtfully. "There was no mention of any woman at dinner?"
"Oh, why, of course," cried Evesham. "He announced his engagement. That's just what made it seem so absolutely mad. Very bucked about it he was. Said it wasn't to be announced just yet, but gave us the hint that he was in the running for the Benedict Stakes." "Of course, we all guessed who the lady was," said Conway. "Marjorie Dilke. Nice girl. It seemed to be Mr. Quinn's turn to speak, but he did not do so, and something about his silence seemed oddly provocative. It was as though he challenged the last statement. It had the effect of putting Conway in a defensive position.
Who else could it have been? Evesham?
I don't know, said Tom Evesham slowly.
What did he say exactly now?
Something about being in the running for the Benedict Stakes, that he couldn't tell us the lady's name till he had her permission. It wasn't to be announced yet. He said, I remember, that he was a damn lucky fellow, that he wanted his two old friends to know that by that time next year he'd be a happy married man. Of course, we assumed it was Marjorie. They were great friends, and he'd been about with her a lot.
Oh, the only thing, began Conway and stopped.
What were you going to say, Dick?
Well, I mean, it was odd in a way, if it were Marjorie, that the engagement shouldn't be announced at once. Why the secrecy? Sounds more as though it were a married woman, you know. Someone whose husband had just died, or who was divorcing him.
Oh, that's true, said Evesham. If that were the case, of course, the engagement couldn't be announced at once. And you know, thinking back about it, I don't believe he had been seeing much of Marjorie. Oh, that was the year before. I remember thinking things seemed to have cooled off between them.
Curious, said Mr. Quinn.
Yes, it looked almost as though someone had come between them.
Another woman, said Conway thoughtfully.
By Jove, said Evesham. You know, there was something almost indecently hilarious about old Derek that night. He looked almost drunk with happiness, and yet, I can't quite explain what I mean, but he looked oddly defiant, too.
Like a man defying fate, said Alex Portal heavily.
Was it of Derek Capel he was speaking, or was it of himself? Mr. Satterthwaite, looking at him, inclined to the latter view. Yes, that was what Alex Portal represented. A man defying fate. His imagination, muddled by drink, responded suddenly to that note in the story which recalled his own secret preoccupation. Mr. Satterthwaite looked up. She was still there, watching, listening, still motionless, frozen like a dead woman.
Perfectly true, said Conway. Capel was excited. Curiously so. I describe him as a man who had staked heavily and won against well-nigh overwhelming odds.
Getting up courage, perhaps, for what he's made up his mind to do, suggested Portal. And as though moved by an association of ideas, he got up and helped himself to another drink.
Not a bit of it, said Evesham sharply.
I'd almost swear nothing of that kind was in his mind. Conway's right. A successful gambler was brought off a long shot and can hardly believe in his own good fortune. That was the attitude.
Conway gave a gesture of discouragement.
And yet, he said, 10 minutes later.
They sat in silence. Evesham brought his hand down with a bang on the table.
Something must have happened in that 10 minutes, he cried. It must, but what?
Well, let's go over it carefully. We were all talking.
In the middle of it, Capel got up suddenly and left the room.
Why? Said Mr. Quinn.
The interruption seemed to disconcert Evesham.
I beg your pardon?
I only said why, said Mr. Quinn.
Evesham frowned in an effort of memory.
It didn't seem vital at the time.
Oh, of course, the post. Don't you remember that jangling bell? And how excited we were. We'd been snowed up for 3 days, remember? Biggest snowstorm for years and years. And the roads were impassable. No newspapers, no letters. Capel went out to see if something had come through at last, and got a great pile of things, newspapers and letters. He opened the paper to see if there was any news, and then went upstairs with his letters. 3 minutes afterwards, we heard a shot. Inexplicable, absolutely inexplicable.
Well, that's not inexplicable, said Portal. Of course, the fellow got some unexpected news in a letter, obvious, I should have said.
Oh, don't think we missed anything so obvious as that. It was one of the coroner's first questions.
But Capel never opened one of his letters.
The whole pile lay unopened on his dressing table.
Portle looked crestfallen.
You're sure he didn't open just one of them? He might have destroyed it after reading it.
No, I'm quite positive.
Of course, that would have been the natural solution. No, every one of the letters was unopened. Nothing burnt, nothing torn up, there was no fire in the room.
Portle shook his head. Extraordinary.
It was a ghastly business altogether, said Evesham in a low voice. Conway and I went up when we heard the shot and found him. It gave me a shock, I can tell you.
Nothing to be done but telephone for the police, I suppose, said Mr. Quinn.
Well, Royston wasn't on the telephone then. I had it put in when I bought the place. No, luckily enough, the local constable happened to be in the kitchen at the time. One of the dogs, you remember poor old Rover, Conway, had strayed the day before. A passing carter had found it half buried in a snowdrift and had taken it to the police station. They recognized it as Capel's, and a dog he was particularly fond of, and the constable came up with it. He'd just arrived a minute before the shot was fired. It saved us some trouble.
Gad, that was a snowstorm, said Conway reminiscently.
About this time of year, wasn't it? Early January.
Or February, I think.
Let me see, we went abroad soon afterwards.
I'm pretty sure it was January.
My hunter Ned, remember Ned? Lamed himself at the end of January. That was just after this business.
Well, it must have been quite the end of January, then.
Funny how difficult it is to recall dates after a lapse of years.
One of the most difficult things in the world, said Mr. Quinn conversationally, unless you can find a landmark in some big public event, an assassination of a crowned head or a big murder trial.
Why, of course, cried Conway. It was just before the Appleton case.
Well, just after, wasn't it?
No, no, don't you remember? Capel knew the Appletons. He'd stayed with the old man the previous spring, just a week before he died. He was talking of him one night, what an old curmudgeon he was, and how awful it must have been for a young and beautiful woman like Mrs. Appleton to be tied to him. There was no suspicion then that she'd done away with him.
By Jove, you're right. I remember reading the paragraph in the paper saying an exhumation order had been granted. It would have been that same day. I remember only seeing it with half my mind, you know, the other half wondering about poor old Derek lying dead upstairs.
A common but very curious phenomenon, that, observed Mr. Quinn. In moments of great stress, the mind focuses itself upon some quite unimportant matter, which is remembered long afterwards with the utmost fidelity, driven in, as it were, by the mental stress of the moment. It may be some quite irrelevant detail, like the pattern of a wallpaper. But it will never be forgotten.
Rather extraordinary, you're saying that, Mr. Quinn, said Conway. Just as you were speaking, I suddenly felt myself back in Derek Capel's room, with Derek lying dead on the floor. I saw it as plainly as possible, the big tree outside the window, and the shadow it threw upon the snow outside. Yes, the moonlight, the snow, and the shadow of the tree. I can see them again this minute. By gad, I believe I could draw them. And yet, I never realized I was looking at them at the time.
His room was the big one over the porch, was it not? Asked Mr. Quinn.
Yes. And the tree was the big beech, just at the angle of the drive.
Mr. Quinn nodded as though satisfied. Mr. Satterthwaite was curiously thrilled. He was convinced that every word, every inflection of Mr. Quinn's voice was pregnant with purpose. He was driving at something. Exactly what, Mr. Satterthwaite did not know, but he was quite convinced as to whose was the master hand. There was a momentary pause, and then Evesham reverted to the preceding topic.
That Appleton case, I remembered it very well now. What a sensation it made.
She got off, didn't she?
Pretty woman.
Very fair, remarkably fair.
Almost against his will, Mr. Satterthwaite's eyes sought the kneeling figure up above. Was it his fancy? Or did he see it shrink a little as though at a blow? Did he see a hand slide upwards to the tablecloth and then pause? There was a crash of falling glass. Alex Portle,
helping himself to whiskey, had let the decanter slip.
Oh, I say, sir, damn sorry. Can't think what came over me.
Evesham cut short his apologies.
Oh, quite all right, my dear fellow. Curious, that smash reminded me. That's what she did, didn't she? Mrs. Appleton. Smashed the port decanter?
Yes. Old Appleton had his glass of port, only one each night, the day after his death. One of the servants saw her take the decanter out and smash it deliberately. Well, that set them talking, of course. They all knew she'd been perfectly wretched with him. Rumor grew and grew, and in the end, months later, some of his relatives applied for an exhumation order. And sure enough, the old fellow had been poisoned. Arsenic, wasn't it?
No, strychnine, I think.
It doesn't much matter. Well, of course, there it was. Only one person was likely to have done it. Mrs. Appleton stood her trial. She was acquitted, more through lack of evidence against her than from any overwhelming proof of innocence. In other words, she was lucky. Yes. I don't suppose there's much doubt she did it, right enough. What happened to her afterwards?
Oh, went out to Canada, I believe.
Or was it Australia?
She had an uncle or something of the sort out there who offered her a home. Best thing she could do under the circumstances.
Mr. Satterthwaite was fascinated by Alex Portal's right hand as it clasped his glass. How tightly he was gripping it.
You'll smash that in a minute or two if you're not careful, thought Mr. Satterthwaite. Dear me, how interesting all this is.
Evesham rose and helped himself to a drink.
Well, we're not much nearer to knowing why poor Derek Capel shot himself, he remarked. The Court of Inquiry hasn't been a great success, has it, Mr. Quinn?
Mr. Quinn laughed. It was a strange laugh, mocking, yet sad. It made everyone jump.
I beg your pardon, he said. You are still living in the past, Mr. Evesham. You are still hampered by your preconceived notion. But I, the man from outside, the stranger passing by, see only facts.
Facts?
Yes, facts.
What do you mean?
Said Evesham. I see a clear sequence of facts, outlined by yourselves, but of which you have not seen the significance. Let us go back 10 years and look at what we see, untrammeled by ideas or sentiment.
Mr. Quinn had risen. He looked very tall. The fire leapt fitfully behind him. He spoke in a low, compelling voice.
You are at dinner. Derek Capel announces his engagement. You think then it was to Marjorie Dilke? You are not so sure now. He has the restlessly excited manner of a man who has successfully defied fate, who, in your own words, has pulled off a big coup against overwhelming odds. Then comes the clanging of the bell. He goes out to get the long overdue mail. He doesn't open his letters, but you mention yourselves that he opened the paper to glance at the news. It is 10 years ago. So we cannot know what the news was that day, a far-off earthquake, a near-at-hand political crisis. The only thing we do know about the contents of that paper is that it contained one small paragraph. A paragraph stating that the Home Office had given permission to exhume the body of Mr. Appleton 3 days ago.
What?
Mr. Quinn went on. Derek Capel goes up to his room, and there he sees something out of the window. Sir Richard Conway has told us that the curtain was not drawn across it, and further, that it gave onto the drive. What did he see? What could he have seen that forced him to take his life?
What do you mean, what did he see?
I think, said Mr. Quinn, that he saw a policeman. A policeman who had come about a dog. But Derek Capel didn't know that. He just saw a policeman.
There was a long silence, as though it took some time to drive the inference home.
My God, whispered Evesham at last, you can't mean that. Appleton? But he wasn't there
at the time Appleton died. The old man was alone with his wife.
But he may have been there a week earlier. Strychnine is not very soluble, unless it is in the form of hydrochloride. The greater part of it, put into the port, would be taken in the last glass, perhaps a week after he left. Portle sprung forward. His voice was hoarse, his eyes bloodshot.
"Why did she break the decanter?" he cried. "Why did she break the decanter? Tell me that!"
For the first time that evening, Mr. Quinn addressed himself to Mr. Satterthwaite. "You have a wide experience of life, Mr. Satterthwaite. Perhaps you can tell us that." Mr. Satterthwaite's voice trembled a little. His cue had come at last. He was to speak some of the most important lines in the play. He was an actor now, not a looker-on.
"As I see it," he murmured modestly, "she cared for Derek Capel. She was, I think, a good woman, and she had sent him away. When her husband died, she suspected the truth, and so to save the man she loved, she tried to destroy the evidence against him. Later, I think, he persuaded her that her suspicions were unfounded, and she consented to marry him. But even then, she hung back. Women, I fancy, have a lot of instinct."
Mr. Satterthwaite had spoken his part.
Suddenly, a long, trembling sigh filled the air. "My God!" cried Evesham, starting. "What was that?"
Mr. Satterthwaite could have told him that it was Eleanor Portle in the gallery above, but he was too artistic to spoil a good effect. Mr. Quinn was smiling. "My car will be ready by now. Thank you for your hospitality, Mr. Evesham. I have, I hope, done something for my friend." They stared at him in blank amazement. "That aspect of the matter has not struck you? He loved this woman, you know. Loved her enough to commit murder for her sake. When retribution overtook him, as he mistakenly thought, he took his own life. But unwittingly, he left her to face the music."
"She was acquitted," muttered Evesham.
"Because the case against her could not be proved. I fancy, it may be only a fancy, that she is still facing the music."
Portle had sunk into a chair, his face buried in his hands. Quinn turned to Satterthwaite.
"Goodbye, Mr. Satterthwaite. You are interested in the drama, are you not?"
Mr. Satterthwaite nodded, surprised.
"I must recommend the Harlequinade to your attention. It is dying out nowadays, but it repays attention, I assure you. Its symbolism is a little difficult to follow, but the immortals are always immortal, you know. I wish you all good night."
They saw him stride out into the dark. As before, the colored glass gave the effect of motley. Mr. Satterthwaite went upstairs. He went to draw down his window, for the air was cold. The figure of Mr. Quinn moved down the drive, and from a side door came a woman's figure, running. For a moment they spoke together. Then she retraced her steps to the house. She passed just below the window, and Mr. Satterthwaite was struck anew by the vitality of her face. She moved now like a woman in a happy dream.
"Eleanor!"
Alex Portle had joined her. "Eleanor, forgive me. Forgive me. You told me the truth, but God forgive me, I didn't quite believe." Mr. Satterthwaite was intensely interested in other people's affairs, but he was also a gentleman. It was borne in upon him that he must shut the window. He did so. But he shut it very slowly. He heard her voice, exquisite and indescribable.
"I know, I know. You've been in hell. So was I once. Loving, yet alternately believing and suspecting. Thrusting aside one's doubts and having them spring up again with leering faces. I know, Alex, I know. But there is a worse hell than that. The hell I have lived in with you. I have seen your doubt, your fear of me, poisoning all our love. That man, that chance passerby, saved me. I could bear it no longer, you understand. Tonight I was going to kill myself. Alex. Alex.
We hope you have enjoyed The Coming of Mr. Quinn, a Harley Quinn short story by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser. The Mysterious Mr. Quinn, text copyright 1930, Agatha Christie Limited. Production copyright 2005, HarperCollins Publishers Limited, all rights reserved. If you've enjoyed this Agatha Christie story, don't miss The Mysterious Mr. Quinn, a Harley Quinn collection. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.